This is the Orange Podcast, conversations with Orange City Council for the local community.
Lifting the lid on what's happening in the corridors of Orange City Council, you've tuned in to the Orange Podcast. This is Alan Reader with an in-depth look at one man's evidence to a Senate inquiry in Orange this week.
What's happened in the past, we've had local groups and regional groups, we've had reference group advisory groups to every social service here, whether it's housing, education, hospitals, police, and we haven't had the outcomes that we've expected to achieve from those groups. Because when we have interaction with governments and we say, we would love to do this, and government entertains it, there's an expectation of community, yeah, this is going to happen, right? And it's never happened.
More from Orange Local Aboriginal Lands Council Chair Jamie Newman later in the program. But first up today, the Orange Regional Gallery has just wound up on what could well be its biggest ever exhibition. A sculpture exhibition by internationally renowned artist Lawrence Edwards was on show at the gallery for a couple of months, and during that time, no less than 8,000 people came through the doors. Gallery director Brad Hammond was very pleased with the results.
It's been a great experience for us at the gallery. It was one of our most popular shows ever in the gallery's history. We're sorry to see it go, but at least a major piece is staying with us.
8,000 people came through in a couple of months. Is that unusually high?
It's unusually high. So it's a great result for us because, there's 8,000 people, but we saw a kind of really even split between people travelling long distances to see the show and many repeat visitors from our local audience, so that was really exciting. The other thing, too, is just the depth of connection that people felt with Lawrence Edwards' work and what they were telling us about what were they appreciating about the show through our surveys and also just anecdotally at the front desk. Yeah, it's been really uplifting for us. And, you know, we took a bit of a gamble with this show. We weren't sure, you know, it was coming out from overseas. But I just felt initially the work was really significant and this was an opportunity that we couldn't miss because it sort of evolved out of the gallery extension project. And so I'm really, really pleased with that result.
For the Orange Podcast, we interviewed Lawrence Edwards back when it was first being installed. He had all sorts of hopes for how it would connect with other people. What sort of quality of feedback did you get from people? How well did it connect?
Well, people are saying it's one of the most powerful exhibitions I've ever seen. So we had that a few times, people saying that, that it was well worth the visit, that they were very surprised to see such a powerful exhibition in a regional area and delighted that many people stumbled across it. You know, they're on their travels and they came across it. But really what I think they're telling us is that this work was meaningful to them in two ways. The one is that there's such an incredible skill level that people marveled at in terms of the bronze casting, the handling of the medium, which is rare these days. Lawrence is continuing on an ancient tradition, but he's one of the few artists who actually cast his own work. People really appreciate that level of skill. And then also the other part was the psychological state of the figures, what they seem to be feeling and what they're going through, which is a state of uncertainty and great self-doubt or disruption. They're having to migrate, they're having to move, they're being forced to leave. This is really interesting because they're all male figures. So the traditional male bronze figure is a victor in the city square, you know, on top of a plinth, great academic, great explorer, great warrior. This is different. These guys are actually being forced to leave places. They're having to gather up whatever they can find to survive in an unknown world that they're forced to move to. So this is a theme that people really resonated with. And they were telling us that. And it's great to see. I think that's what art should do. It really moves people, connects people. And it did all of those things for us.
A huge reputational boost for the gallery, a significant personal impact for the people who came and saw it. Let's talk about economic impacts. 8,000 people. If 8,000 people came for a festival or for a sporting event, that'd be millions of dollars in terms of accommodation and food. This exhibition has had a huge economic impact on the Orange region.
Yeah, I mean, I think that cultural tourism is a very real, phenomenon, and I think when councils like our council believe in it and take it seriously, you see the results. You see it all around the world that art is a real draw card. Cultural experiences are a real draw card for people to travel and also to decide to live in a region. So that definitely flows out. It translates into the broader community. It's just one facet of what's on offer. But yeah, it definitely is a reason for people to come and spend a weekend. And we definitely saw that with the show.
The Lawrence Edward exhibition is now scattered around Australia and New Zealand, but one piece has stayed here. Could you tell me the story of how that happened and where you got the money from to do that?
So we have an active community group that support us, the Friends of Orange Regional Gallery, or FORG. They've been operating with us for the last 35 years, so they're an integral part to the history and the story of the gallery. They raise funds, so they're a fundraising community. So this purchase was purely from fundraising. We don't have a mechanism through council to purchase works for the collection. We rely purely on the generosity of volunteers and also from donors for different works. So I think this is a major acquisition. It's a great community statement and a belief in the work that Lawrence is doing and also what we're doing here at the gallery. I love that this work will be viewable for forever, and it belongs to the people of Orange. And I think we'll hear a lot more about Lawrence Edwards in the future as one of the major artists of our time. And he's continuing to work on interesting and fascinating projects now, and we'll probably be back at some point. So yeah, we've got a lovely connection. It's a new kind of friendship with also Messams in the UK, who are a fantastic organization, arts organization, who do amazing work. So this is a really lovely partnership as well for the gallery and for our community.
As we've heard, the good news is that one of the bronze sculptures will stay as part of the permanent collection, bought and donated by the Friends of the Regional Gallery Organisation. The Friends chair is Richard Walker.
Back in the mid-80s, the community was pushing for a gallery, which didn't exist at that time, and the Friends basically spawned out of that community effort, and along with the contribution of the Margaret Olley collection and the pressure that was being put by the community at that stage, the Friends developed out of that, and they've been going for as long as the gallery's been going, and we've been supporting the gallery in this way, purchasing works for the gallery since then.
The gallery is funded largely by Orange City Council, but the council's got a very limited budget when it comes to buying new pieces of art. Is that where the Friends can step in?
It is. In fact, it's the only source of funds that Brad has at hand, basically to purchase new works for the collection. And he's got a theme and a policy in relation to the actual collection itself, which is broken up into various themes. And occasionally, something comes along that catches his eye that will add to the collection itself. So he then approaches the members of the actual Friends of the gallery to see whether they'll agree to purchase it. We always do.
Where do you get your money from?
One source is our membership. We get about probably a quarter of our membership from that source. We cater for activities here in the gallery. When the gallery has an exhibition, we cater serving alcohol and provide some food, which is part of the process of when people come, that they can share in that. And we run events. So, things like the sculptures in the garden we had a couple of years ago, 2 years in a row, we raised $50,000 out of those 2 years. And we also have planned for this year, we had one last year as well, a secret art auction. We ask local artists to provide a very small work, unsigned, and it's put up on the wall, and people come along and look at it and basically select it on appeal. Well, they don't know who the artist is until they turn the thing over. And quite often we've got artists of some significance donating paintings to those as well as amateurs and also school kids and things like that. But we made a significant amount of money at that last year, and we're going to hold another one of those later this year. So.
And that lets you make purchases like the one we're looking at now, a huge Lawrence Edward head that's probably going to be hugely valuable in future years. $45,000, is that a good investment for the Friends and for the community of Orange for the future?
Well, it's certainly an investment for the collection within the gallery itself, and Brad Hammond, the director, will vouch for that in that way. For the Friends and for the greater members of the community, it's a significant artwork in its own right, and it's something that Not too many other galleries around have a specimen such as that to add to their sort of feathers in their cap. So it's a significant work.
Richard Walker from the Friends of the Orange Regional Gallery. The awareness campaign around the Voice referendum later this year is stepping up as we all begin to get our heads around this important change for Australia's future. A parliamentary inquiry into the legislation is now underway, and when they made their first stop for a hearing outside Canberra, they chose Orange. In Orange this week, they listened to evidence and questioned a number of witnesses on how the Voice could work and what difference it could make. One First Nations organisation that's been dealing with the federal government for decades is the Orange Aboriginal Medical Service. The service's CEO is Jamie Newman.
Very, very pleased. It was a good opportunity to share with not only the community of Orange and those who attended, but to present our case, or my position personally and professionally, to the panel of senators that were there, about the need to have a voice in our country and enshrined in the Constitution.
You're the CEO of the medical service. What does the experience of the Orange Aboriginal Medical Service bring to the debate about vote yes or no in the referendum?
Well, we've been operating for 18 years and very successfully. But that success has come at a cost to us. You know, we've been knocked back on a lot of opportunities to grow our service quicker. And we are progressing that. We are multi-diversified service now. It's not just healthcare. Healthcare is our platform, Alan. But we also have an out-of-home care service, NDIS provider, and soon to be moving into aged care. So our most vulnerable people are in those cohorts. But we found over 18 years that our people are still disengaged, especially in the most vulnerable. So our diversification supports our healthcare element. I don't believe that NDIS or aged care or people in care, especially children in care, if without having good, effective healthcare, they're not going to get quality whole of life. And that's what our focus is as a service. The barriers that exist for us and for the last 18 years is the chopping and changing of what we've got to report against, who we've got to report it to, what the feedback is if we're not hitting the mark. You're never going to run a service of government-driven key performance indicators, because my position is, and the position of our organisation, is what they're asking us to demonstrate is output. So we can have every Aboriginal person in Orange on a health check. Doesn't mean their health's going to change. It doesn't mean their social circumstances are going to change. Doesn't mean their financial circumstances are going to change. So if we look at the definition of Aboriginal health, it's about dealing with all, not only their physical and social and emotional well-being, but their housing, their education, their employment. So it becomes a whole of community approach. So being the health provider is a critical link for our kids in school, whether that's in primary school or secondary, even into tertiary education, getting our people jobs, getting them housed, and getting them functional in community. So it's a massive job. Healthcare isn't just dealing with sickness and disease. So we're in that space now after 18 years of learning, and we're still learning, which is a good thing. But what we've learnt over those 18 years is that there are multiple layers of bureaucracy that I don't believe support self-determination. I think it's more that we want to give output-driven, not outcome-focused. And that's what we need to change. I'm hoping the voice will be that voice at the senior level, right? I like to see it as that it's a key performance indicator for the government to be held accountable to. Every funding contract that we get as an Aboriginal medical service as KPI, so they keep us accountable to government. I believe our voice can be the vehicle for us to keep them accountable to us. We elect the politicians into the government, but there's no performance measure for them. You know, they're listening to the constituents. And I know, and I've listened to some of the Senate estimates, and I do not want to be in that place. But understand that we need to be in that place at some level, because that's where the change can occur. Mm. We've over many years had local groups, we've had regional bodies, and they haven't hit the mark because there's no connection to the executive level of governance in this country. And the Constitution is that. The Constitution will keep people accountable.
It seems like you're suggesting two different things there. There's a better communication that can come from the voice, but also accountability.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about communication first. Mm-hmm. How could a voice make it easier, make it improve those lines of communication between the Indigenous community and government?
One thing that we spoke about when we had Minister Burney out here a couple of months ago, but that we can't do the same old, is the same thing that's happened for us for generations. We need to have a change. And we heard from Alicia yesterday, the Young Youth Dialogue Network member, who happens to be from Orange and our chairperson of our Aboriginal Medical Service, 26 years of age. For her to be involved should speak volumes to the panel yesterday and to those in attendance, that our young people are the disengaged cohort that we're trying to change the generation for them. So health outcomes, housing, employment, education, we want better outcomes for that younger cohort. But the communication in the past has denied them that opportunity to speak. So young people will not engage if they're not involved in the discussion. What we see as the best communication tool we can use is our young people, allowing them to be at the table, not to just focus everything on our older people or elders. That has some cultural significance to it, but it can't be the be-all and end-all. There have been multiple layers and multiple opportunities where we have community consultations, community gathering, community input, and majority of those times have been older people. People who work in organisations and people that are either on the fringe or involved heavily in what's happening in our local communities. But the gap that we've had is the participation by our young people. So we see this voice as encouraging our young people to take a stand, and having the youth dialogue to the Uluru Statement is critical because it shows that our young people want to be involved. We don't have really solid succession plans in our communities because we don't communicate the need for our young people to be involved. Some of the questions yesterday from the panel was, how do we encourage young people to be involved? You've got to communicate at a young person's level. I'm 58 years of age. People don't want to listen to me. Not at that cohort level that we need to engage, but they will listen to Alicia.
So an elected body that was represented all the regions of Australia might have some young people in it, might have a network that could listen to young people?
I think if we don't have young people on that highest level, we're going to be disconnected on the chain down. So we can have young people voices in the region, but young people are going to be more attracted to the executive. So whatever that detail would look like, and it's, you know, got some discussions around what it would look like, if there's going to be, say, 12 people on that voice to Parliament, I'd be encouraging that have at least four young people. And I'm talking young being 25 to 40. There's the group that we need to be making decisions for the generations that's coming, for their generation now, for the generation that's coming. And I mentioned yesterday about my kids and my grandkids. The younger people understand the environment now. I understand my era, 58 plus, or even the 50s plus, and we need to make some changes ourselves. But if we have consistency and constancy and what that would give for us. And we're not expecting that the voice is going to get us more money, it's going to get us more resources. There may be some elements to that, but I'm not relying on the voice to get more money for the Orange Aboriginal Medical Service. There's already structures there. We just need to make those structures accountable to us. It's not the voice to say, no, we need Orange to be funded this and Bathurst to be funded that. That's not going to happen. Mm. We want the voice to be that where it's a body of people that have the skills to be able to lobby, negotiate, discuss, table, and then to feed back to whether it's regions or communities on what is happening at that. I don't want to know every paper that's presented to Parliament. That's none of my business. I want to know that if we have a concern in the Aboriginal health sector, that there's a vehicle, even though we have a state and national peak Aboriginal health bodies, they still haven't hit the mark either. They've been around a lot longer than us, and yet we're still struggling to get actual funding to run our medical services. We're given a budget based on population numbers, but it's nearly, you look at any Aboriginal medical service in accountable terms, financial accountable terms, we're operating insolvent. That's not a good aspiration for young people to take over running our medical services or our land councils. How do we create a future for young people if we're saying we're not actually funded what we need to be funded, but we've got to run a business and we've got to generate income? And in the land council's point of view, we've got to be able to get land and then make that land prosperous for us. So you need to set a platform where our young people come into our sector, whether it's the Aboriginal Medical Service or Land Council, and they're running businesses, not running arts and crafts or having a doctor turn up once a month or a dentist once every 6 months. It's constant healthcare services. It's constant economic development. That is what the carrot we need to encourage our young people to say, yeah, I want to be the CEO of the Orange Aboriginal Medical Service one day, or the CEO of the Orange Local Aboriginal Land Council one day.
We talked about communication earlier on. Let's talk about accountability. There's the idea that the voice will bring the voice of Indigenous people to the government, to the parliament, and to the executive. How will that translate to accountability, coming back the other way?
There are some things that is not going to happen, right? We know that what's happened in the past, we've had local groups and regional groups, we've had reference group advisor groups to every social service here, whether it's housing, education, hospitals, police, and we haven't had the outcomes that we've expected to achieve from those groups. Accountability for us as Aboriginal people is a body where we could push things up and say, what do you think about this, before it even gets to the parliament. A body can say to us, straight, open and honest dialogue, that's not going to happen. Because when we have interaction with governments and we say, we would love to do this, and government entertains it, there's an expectation from community, yeah, this is going to happen, right? And it's never happened. We've developed our organisation based on what we see as what we need, based on data, based on evidence, based on need from our community, and based on what we see as gaps in Orange. We're not looking at what's outside of Orange, even though we attract people staff-wise and service-wise. So the accountability for us as an organisation to be participant on The Voice is more around the health element of it and the diversified business. But for The Voice to say to us, oh, we want to set up a bike track, that's not going to happen. But if we're entertained, whether it's by a local body, regional body, or even a state body, says, well, there might be some merit in that. But then we create expectation. So we want this voice to be able to say, if we're going to push something up from a regional level, for them to say, that is not the priority. Maybe you should be thinking about this, or maybe you should be thinking about that. So the voice works between government and us.
You're talking about self-determination again, aren't you?
Absolutely. Because if there isn't self-determination for us, you'll never have accountability. Self-determination can only happen when there's accountability from and by Aboriginal people, and that vehicle being up and coming back. If we haven't learnt now, even through the Close the Gap, accountability is not strong in our sector, and I'm not just pushing all that blame onto government. We have to be accountable as Aboriginal community-controlled organisations. Our governance is critical, our operations are even more critical, and how we run our organisations to be effective, that's outcome-focused, that is a strength-based focus, not a deficit-based. After 18 years of working, or 23 years of working in the health sector, I'm past this poor Aboriginal health status. It's not encouraging to bring people into our sector, Alan, by saying, we've got the poorest health outcomes. We have the highest incidence of this, the highest prevalence of this. Our people are still dying 10, 15 years younger than non-Aboriginal people.
That sounds like something's failing. Not a thing I want to be a part of.
How's that going to attract a doctor? How's that going to attract a psychologist? How's that going to attract a dentist? We are struggling at the moment with workforce right across the board, not just in the Aboriginal community controlled health sector, but in mainstream. It's how we work collaboratively. And we talked about yesterday about the dispersed funding that comes into our regions and into our communities. Orange, as an example, is the health precinct for the region. It is admired far and wide, yet we still have disconnection here with all the healthcare providers that we have in our communities. One of the key funding areas that we've been funded for is to create a network so that all of our healthcare providers in town are working collectively. That is significant for us. If we focus on the gaps that exist between our service providers, then I believe we're going to get better health outcomes on not just for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, but for the general population.
When we had, as an Australian community, back at the start of 1901, and we set up a new parliament, I've heard some discussion this week that for the first couple of years, it really wasn't much good. When we voted to have it, we weren't too sure whether about the details or not. As the yes and no debate starts to heat up, there's some parts of the debate are looking at, we need more details. We can't say yes unless we have more details. What do you think?
Mate, I don't think there was a lot of detail even in the 67 referendum to recognise and accept Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people. It's been an evolution since 1967. I don't think we should be asking for detail now. I could honestly tell you that the government doesn't have that detail correct. I don't think our communities will have it correct because you've still got this debate. I don't think it's division because I hear from certain senators now across the country that this racial position of the enshrined voice in the Constitution will create division. Let's not put our head in the sand. There's division in every community. And it's not just
racial. You'd be surprised if it wasn't.
I'd say we'd be floating on air if we say there's no division. There is division everywhere. There's division, more division in Aboriginal communities, and I'm not talking the broader community.
Sure.
No, there's cultural differences, there's social differences, there could be professional and personal differences. That happens in every community. So to blanket Australia, say, well, this is going to create more division or going to create a division, we know racism exists. We don't turn a blind eye to that. We know lateral violence exists in Aboriginal communities. We don't hear a lot about that, but we need to. If we're going to be fair, then yes, we're dealing with racism, but we're also dealing with lateral violence where our people attack one another over differences of opinion or differences of culture. We want to try and bridge that gap. We can't do it if we don't have a pathway to the highest level of governance in this country, the Constitution, because that's what holds people accountable. Last 19 years, we haven't had that. Governments change, institutions change, policy changes, strategy changes, people change. So we've been fighting an uphill battle, and for us to be 18 years, it's testament to our desire to see change for our people. If we don't have that desire, and I've said this openly to whether it's students who come through our service or ministers or funding agencies, if you don't have a desire for change and desire for outcomes for our people, get out. I say that to myself. If I haven't the desire to see our organisation be successful, which I believe a strong, functional Aboriginal community is good for the general community, and we should embrace that. I've said to groups I talk to that we're the oldest living culture in the world. We should celebrate that. Most countries where they have the oldest or the first or the this is unique, they celebrate it, and we should celebrate that as well. I'm not saying we're perfect. Australia as a country is not perfect, but we can be perfected in how we see each other.
Jamie, I'm seeing a generosity of spirit across the Australian community that's going to vote yes. Are you optimistic of a yes vote?
I'm hopeful. In my opening introduction yesterday, I reflected back to my family saying, I bet my grandparents and my parents were hopeful of the 67 referendum because we were on a mission. Spent first 3 years of my life. I was born 64, so 67 we were seen and recognised. Now, I can't remember what year it was when we moved from our mission in Condobolin to in town. But as the guest that my parents were hopeful of the 67 referendum being the change for us, I'm hoping this referendum will be the change for us, for my kids and my grandkids.
Jamie Newman, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Alan.
Orange Aboriginal Medical Service CEO, Jamie Newman. And if you want to find out more about The Voice, the local Yes campaign is organising a number of face-to-face gatherings here in Orange, the first one in mid-May. Details will be publicised in the coming weeks. And that's the Orange podcast for this week. Remember, you can leave a review of this program wherever you get your podcasts. That can help someone else find this show. And it's always good to hear direct feedback from people listening all over the planet. You can email us at podcast@orange.nsw.gov.au. That's podcast@orange.nsw.gov.au. The Orange Podcast is produced on Wiradjuri Country. Until next time, this is Alan Reader. Bye for now.